Bob. First of all, let's make some general comments. So we have, in order to violate the prohibition of ribis minatoria, so you have to have it set in advance that that is the case. So we call ribis ketutza. Now that could include whether you say a rate or a dollar value. That could include, if we're talking about commodities, all of that I think we've established already. It could include a couple of other circumstances also. It's interesting, it's the machlokas, the Rambam and the Ravid. What happens if I extend the period of a loan? Let's say you borrow money from me and I don't charge you interest, and then you come back and you come to me after a month and you say that I'm just not ready to pay, so can I have another month? And I give you another month, and I say, but then you got to pay me interest. So that was my focus between the Rambam and the Ravid, if that's called ribis ketutz or not. It's definitely prohibited one way or another.
Why would that be considered ribis if it's just like you're buying extra time?
But buying time in the first place would be ribis ketutz. Right, definitely, it's definitely ribis on some level because you're paying for the time. That's what ribis is by definition, right? But the question is, ribis ketutza requires that it be set from the very beginning of the deal. So this was done in the middle of the deal, but it extended the deal. So is that seen as a new deal or not?
How are you? I may have missed this, but why isn't time like a commodity?
Yeah, so we discussed that a little bit last week. That essentially, it is an open question. Why is it that? It's not so much why isn't time a commodity, it's why isn't money a commodity, right? Then why don't we say that if we have a concept of rental, that I can charge you for my car or my apartment, even if you don't get to keep it, but you're just borrowing it, and I can charge you for that, so why can't I rent you my money also and charge you for that? So that's a philosophical question, which we discussed a little bit last week. We discussed just broader questions of why the Torah might have such a consideration against ribis, which in the interest of time I won't necessarily rehash now. I'll direct you to the tape, but we did talk also just more specifically about that question. Aside from those philosophical considerations, why can't I rent my money to you just like I can rent my property to you? And we mentioned, I think we mentioned one suggestion that money by itself doesn't do anything. Money only grows because people work to grow it. So if I gave you my car has usage. My apartment has usage. My money doesn't really have usage. If my money comes back more valuable, it's because you made it into something for your toil. So maybe, this is what was a suggestion, it appears in a sefer called Nesiv HaShalom, not to be confused with the Slonim Rebbe, a different Nesiv HaShalom, that asserts that that's why it's essentially immoral to charge someone for themselves. Essentially, you're basically saying that their ability to work and make the money grow, you want to force them to give to you, that's perhaps wrong. Okay, so let's talk a little bit, actually, before we add to these other categories of what is ribis ketutza and what is not. So let's also talk a little bit about what might make things better. Where do you find ribis sometimes perhaps permitted or not considered to be ribis? So one rule is that it's only ribis if it goes from the lender to the borrower. But if you have it going to someone or coming from someone in the middle, so that's not called ribis. So what does that mean, though? That does that mean that if I want to borrow money from Ariel, so I can tell Yonatan to give him the ribis in the middle, just have him as a middleman? That's not what it means. It doesn't work that way. It means that, let's say, for example, I tell Yonatan, please convince Ariel to lend me money. And if you do a good job, I'll pay you for doing a good job. So that's money that's extra to the loan, but I'm paying it to you, not to the lender. That's permissible. And alternatively, let's say you were to say to Ariel, please lend the money. It would really be a nice thing to do, and you throw in some bucks to convince him to do it. So there, money went to the lender, but it didn't come from me, it came from you. So in those circumstances, that's not called ribis. Ribis has to come from the borrower to the lender and not to or from a person in the middle. But just using him as a middleman is not going to be what we're talking about. That's still prohibited. And another example, which you could have thought was okay, but is not. Let's say, for example,
So you want to tell him borrows money from me, and he's willing to pay interest. And I say, don't pay the interest to me, pay the interest to Yosef. So that's also the same thing as ribbis. That's probably a Torah prohibition. Because if I'm telling you to give it to him in my instruction, that's as if I'm getting it. That's called in the Gemara Rivis Midin Arif.
Even if he's not going to give it to you afterwards?
Right. Even if it's for him, he's going to keep it forever, but you're giving it to him because I told you to. That's not an example of the exemption we just said, and that's actually prohibited. So that comes up a lot because you might think it's a good idea. Somebody says to you, let's say, let me borrow money from you and I'll pay you interest. You say, well, I can't take interest, the Torah prohibition. You know what? Give it to the yeshiva instead. Sounds like a good idea. Give it to this poor person. You're willing to pay interest. I don't want it to go to waste. Give it to charity. Sounds like a very noble thing to do. Unfortunately, that's also a problem because that's what we just said, ribbis midin arev. And you might think, okay, it should be mitigated because you're giving it to a tzedakah. Unfortunately, that doesn't help either. One of the differences between ribbis d'oraisa and ribbis d'rabbanan, just to explain this for a second, so does it make a difference in practice if ribbis is prohibited min haTorah or ribbis is prohibited mid rabbanan? So it makes a few differences. It's prohibited either way, right? So say, what difference does it make? So the most prominent difference that it makes is that when it comes to ribbis, let's say, I mentioned three differences. One difference is that if it's ribbis min haTorah, so the rule is ribbis d'orais or ribbis ketsutza, yotze bidayanim, which means that I'm obligated, if I'm a lender and I took interest from you, so I'm obligated to give it back. That's actually a specific pasuk in the Torah. It's an additional pasuk. I have to give it back to you. So Bezdin, it was a machlokus in the Gemara, but we paskin that Bezdin will enforce that. Bezdin will compel me to return the money. And that's a whole interesting question, what the nature of that process is. Maybe it's a little bit outside of our scope. If you want, I can show you some nice discussions about it. But in any event, that's basically the rule. When it comes to ribbis d'rabbanan, so we don't compel you to give it back. Bezdin doesn't compel you to give it back. It's a question, even though Bezdin doesn't compel you, maybe it's still a good idea. If you want to be morally perfect, maybe you should give it back. So that depends on what category of drabanan it is. We'll discuss that. There are different categories of ribbis drabanan. So if it's some categories, we say that lotzis l'day shamayim, on a moral level, it's good to give it back. And others, we say there isn't even any point in giving it back. You weren't supposed to do it to begin with, but after the fact, you don't have to give it back. So that's one of the major differences between ribbis d'oraisa and ribbis drabanan. Another major difference in practice is that we do have an attitude to allow the usage of ribbis d'rabbanan on behalf of a tzedakah, on behalf of a charity, but not on behalf of, not in the case of ribbis d'oraisa. So that comes up a lot, and that's a big issue. A third major difference is that the Gemara says that the prohibition of ribbis applies not just to the lender, but applies to the borrower also, and to everybody who's involved, also to the scribes, to the lawyers, to the secretary, anybody who's a part of the process, to the sofer. Anybody who's a part of making it happen is all in violation of a Torah prohibition. So that's only true if it's ribbis min haTorah. If it's ribbis midrabbanan, so then there still are other issues with facilitating the prohibition. There's a prohibition with the ivir lo sitei michshol. You're not supposed to help with the transgression, but that has other parameters to it. But the isser is really only on the lender under those circumstances. So those are three major differences. So the problem is, if I do this trick where I say, don't pay the ribbis to me, pay it to the yeshiva instead, so then it seems like, first of all, I'm in violation of ribbis d'oraisa, and I'll also have to pay it back, which will really put me in a bad shape, because I'll pay it back out of my pocket. I never got it in the first place. The yeshiva got the money, and I'll pay the ribbis out of my pocket, so it's not really such an efficient plan. If you want to make a donation to the yeshiva, just give it out of your pocket. Don't have this guy give him the interest, because it's not going to end up serving you well. So that's also not this exception. This idea that ribbis only applies when it goes straight from lender to the borrower doesn't mean that you're just using a middleman, and it doesn't mean that you are having to pay someone else. It means that if a middleman decides on his own to pay the lender in order to get him to lend to the borrower, or if the borrower hires a middleman in order to convince the lender to lend him, or whatever it is, so then it's a genuine intervention of a third party, so then there's no prohibition of ribbis under those circumstances.
Sorry, yeah. The third nafkamina, there's yotzei bet hayonin, there's
right.
that some types of ribbis terabonin are acceptable for a tzedakah organization.
Right. Over the third. And the third is that there's also a concept that everyone involved is in violation of an isser, not just the lender, but also the borrower, and also the sofer, and the lawyer, and whoever is working it out, so that only really applies when it's Minat Torah, even though there are other issues with facilitating a transgression, but that's that principle doesn't apply. Ilan?
You may have addressed this, sorry, it was late, but
yeah, that's right.
In regards to the
charge you for waiting time, yeah?
Instances where ribbis would be permissible, though, it seems though that it's almost like they're all loopholes. So, in a sense, why would it say that these things are usher and then come with so many decisions and say, okay, well, it's permissible in certain instances?
Well, it's not so simple. I mean, the quote-unquote loopholes, we'll discuss them, we haven't really got to them, but they only work within certain mechanisms, certain parameters. And as we'll explain, they're hopefully a way of preserving both the spirit and the letter of the law, and that sometimes the halacha really wants to prohibit a certain action from happening, and then there isn't any quote-unquote loophole from it. And sometimes it's more a question that we need to have a certain awareness and a sensitivity, and the quote-unquote loophole will compel us to follow that path, but we're not necessarily interested in making sure that the result doesn't take place. So we'll try, hopefully in the course of today, we'll try to discuss how that plays out a little bit. Yosef?
It seems a little bit strange that my rapist, anyone who's involved, I mean, even the victim person, like, kind of, he's responsible for it. You say someone who knows he's being mugged, or he knows he's being...
So that's what we discussed last week, right? That was definitely one of the very striking things. I didn't mean to cut you off just in the interest of time, because we just talked about last week. That's definitely one of the very striking things about ribbis. So that's why we presented some possible explanations, you know, that maybe it's not really an interpersonal offense, that as far as the person paying, it's reasonable. It's reasonable to ask him to pay a little bit of a return. You're not really hurting him. But if I was exploiting him with some type of rate that pushes him into the poorhouse, then in a chanami, that would also be an interpersonal offense. But the very basic right, reasonable rate of interest that the Torah prohibits, it's not because I'm exploiting the lender. The lender has to be okay with that. But it's because of something else. Maybe it's an offense against God, like we suggested last week, who wants you to engage in chesed without having a guaranteed return. Or you could also explain it differently. You could say that maybe it is an interpersonal offense, but that we have to make sure that we don't allow anyone to willingly participate, because then that will undermine the entire societal participation. So if we say that I'm not allowed to lend ribbis unless the guy says it's okay, so then I'll force him to say it's okay. So maybe we have to cut off that possibility. The guy can't say it's okay, so that no one should ever think that that's a way to get around the protection given to the borrower. So there are a couple of different ways to look at it, but there's no question that's definitely one of the striking details which sets this apart from other monetary offenses, and part of why you have that whole theory that it's not a monetary offense and that it's something that belongs in a different realm. Okay, so this idea, if it doesn't go directly from one party to the next, is an important possible exception. It's also interesting to note that there is a view which seems very striking, because it would really, in terms of loopholes, this would really undermine a lot of the whole ribbis idea. So it's a controversial point, but it's just interesting that Rabbi Schechter is actually somewhat sympathetic to this position. I don't want to say it too strongly, but I think he is somewhat sympathetic to this position, that if the transaction is done with checks, which pretty much all our transactions are done today, so then that itself is going to knock down the prohibition to a drabbanan. It's still prohibited. So, sorry?
Which part, the lending money or the paying bill?
Let's say both. Let's say everything's done with checks. So then that creates already a level drabbanan, not minat Torah. Now, it gets still prohibited, but then there are certain leniencies that might be workable for some circumstances. So that itself is also very significant. Hi. It's based on the idea, it's based on a Gemara a little bit, but it's a longer discussion, but it's based on the assumption that it's not actual money, that a check doesn't, it's a whole, sitting in the library, you can get a sefer, it's about this thick, maybe it's more than that, maybe it's more than one volume, in Yanei, a check, Bahalacha, Tafshin, Ayin, Kuf, that the status of a check is the subject of a lot of discussion. So what is a check? Is a check money, or a check is instruction to your bank to give somebody else money? So it's possible that it's not considered to be money, and therefore a transaction that's done with checks maybe is not considered to involve actual money. Again, the level of the Rabbanim is still going to be prohibited. It may just change the parameters of what we're talking about. So another major area here, and this is something that we'll have to talk about separately, like I said, we put it on our agenda, but just to be aware of so that we can continue to discuss it in this context, what happens when you're dealing with corporations? Okay, this is a whole separate subject, which we'll revisit. But this is, of course, also a huge, huge part of all business dealings. So if you have a corporation or a bank that's involved with Jewish people, that either is owned by Jewish people, or maybe it isn't even owned by Jewish people, but it has Jewish stockholders, maybe not even Jewish stockholders, but it has Jewish customers, so it has, it's lending out Jewish money, essentially. So what's the story there? So is that a problem in terms of ribbis? So that's a major, major debate, some major machlokas. Again, we'll try to revisit it a little bit in other contexts, because it also has implications for Hilchos Pesach and Hilchos Shabbos and Hilchos Basa B'Challah, for all kinds of other areas of Torah law. It has all kinds of implications. But one of the major questions is, does the halacha recognize the concept of a corporation? Is there such a thing? But a corporation is basically a newer invention. The idea, let's say three people get together and they create a corporation. So is that a new entity, or is that the three people? Does the halacha have any such construct to recognize those three people as anything other than those three people acting in partnership? We definitely have a concept of a shutfus, of a partnership, and maybe that's what we're talking about. The idea that it's a new entity that's not a Jewish person, do we recognize that? So is this, so if you know, me and Aaron and Ariel get together and form a corporation and call it the Ribbis Lenders Corporation, so does that mean we're now absolved from the prohibitions of Ribbis? Or do we say, no, that's the three of us Jewish people doing transactions with Ribbis? So it's a major debate, and there are those who were machmir and said, no, there's no such thing as a corporation, and that's subject to the same rule as any individual Jew acting that way. But others felt there was some room to question it. So first of all, it's much easier if you are lending to this corporation. The corporation is borrowing and paying ribbis. So then Rav Moshe Feinstein was very prominently makel on this, and many accepted his ruling in this area. Others didn't. It continues to be somewhat of a debate. But Rav Moshe was very influential in this point. And the logic there is that if the corporation is borrowing, so the whole chap of a corporation, the whole accomplishment of a corporation is that there's no personal liability. And so if we want to come and collect on the loan, who do we collect from? We collect from the corporation's assets. But the three of us who made up the corporation, you can't come after us personally. So the fact that we're not personally liable, maybe that does accomplish something to make us not be the borrowers, and therefore, if you want to lend to a corporation, that could be grounds to be lenient, even if the corporation is made up of Jews. That is very significant. That helps a lot, because, for example, if we're talking about putting your money in a bank, you're essentially lending your money to the bank when you put your money in the bank. So if you want to get interest for putting your money in the bank, and the bank is a Jewish-owned bank or has Jewish stockholders or even other Jews putting money there, so then maybe you have to worry that you're essentially lending money with ribbis to a group of Jews. So the fact that the corporation is recognized, at least to that extent, by those posting we do, that helps a lot, and for many other such circumstances. Hi.
Include in this whole discussion stock dividends and bond payments?
So that's all also complicated. So that also may emerge miscible. Most of the corporation part we'll push off for later, but just to be aware that that's one part of the equation. Now, to go the other direction gets more complicated. What if you want to have a corporation lend money to you with ribbis? So that gets harder, because then we're not looking at whose money it is, we're looking at who's doing the action. And if the corporation is controlled by Jewish people, so then, is it not the case that they are lending you money beribis? So there were those who were very machmir about this, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, for example. And others who disagreed. There was a great posek whose name was Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson, who wrote the Tshuva Shaul Lameshiv. He thought there were grounds to be lenient, and he wrote a letter to the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, who said, please reprint your sefer and change your mind about this. You shouldn't tell everybody they can't do this because it's too important for life. And there are various grounds why they are makel on this. We'll maybe come back to it. We talk a little bit more about corporations, but just to be aware, again, this is one of the major areas of discussion in the laws of Ribbis and in other areas of halacha as well, that if you're dealing with a corporation, it might change the landscape a little bit. So if you're dealing with an intermediary, you're dealing with intermediary doesn't really help, but if the Ribbis is not going to the lender or from the borrower, or if you're dealing with a corporation, or if you're dealing with checks, all of these might make a difference. And for tzedakah, it only really makes a difference if you're dealing with Ribbis d'rabbanan. So all of those theoretically could help. It's also a machlokas. Is it ribbis derais if we call it tzad echad beribbis, which means that there's one scenario in which it's going to be ribbis. I lend you money, and I say, listen, if it works out well for you, I want you to pay me interest. If it doesn't, I'll forget about it. So that's called tzad echad beribbis. That's also prohibited according to everyone. Just a question, is that called ribbis ketsutza? Is that called the Torah violation of ribbis because we're setting it up that way from the beginning? Or should you say that, no, it's not called ribbis ketsutza because I'm not insisting on it from the beginning. I'm only saying it'll happen under one circumstance. Maybe that already makes it not ribbis ketsutza. So that was also a discussion. Okay, so those are some of the things that might make it a little bit better. But now to make things worse, so what are the rabbinical violations of ribbis? So let's say they basically go into three categories. You have what's called, it's really two categories. You have what's called avak ribbis. Avak ribbis means the dust of ribbis. In other areas of Jewish law, avak sometimes means it's still a Torah prohibition. Like you talk about avak lashon hara. So that's also going to be an argument. There's so many things to talk about. So avak lashon hara is a prohibition on a level minat Torah. Avak ribbis is a way to say we're talking about a prohibition midrabanan. Then there's also something called mechzik ribbis. Mechzik ribbis means that it looks like ribbis. It's a lower level prohibition midrabanan. Then some of the Rishonim had another level called tarumas ribbis. It looks like a way to get around ribbis. So for example, if somebody puts a late fee into a deal, that's really a way of basically charging ribbis but calling it something else, not an interest, but calling a late fee. That's also kind of a form of rabbinical ribbis. But there are sometimes when that's permitted. We'll try to discuss that a little bit. So what's an example of avak ribbis? So included in this, for example, the Gemara says that let's say you have the guy do favors for you that he wouldn't have done otherwise. Hi. That's actually one of the conditions. So it's a good point you're raising. Gemara gives an example which prompts a number of the conditions. That it's not clear off the surface what exactly we're talking about. And as Tosfos asks over there in Bav Metzia, what are you telling me? That if somebody lends me money, I have to be mean to him now forever? So I'm nice to everyone else, and I have to be mean to the guy who lends me money? I can't do him favors? Hard to believe. So Tosfos comes up with a couple of conditions to explain what we're talking about. So the Mishnah talks about a situation. Let's say I have an apartment in Jerusalem. Halavai, right? So I have an apartment in Jerusalem, and somebody lends me money. So now he happens to go to Jerusalem. He considers himself entitled to go live in my apartment because he knows that he did me a favor. He lent me money, so he should be entitled to live there even without asking. So Tosfos says that example is very instructive. Because what can you learn from the example? So first of all, it's something very public. Everyone can see that he's living in my apartment, which everyone knows belongs to me. So maybe that's a part of it. So it looks like it's a ribbis deal. Secondly, so the Gemara says that he did it without asking. Maybe that's the whole issue. So your question, that basically, he knows that I'm going to feel I have to provide for him. So therefore, he just happens to go there without asking me. That's when it becomes a problem. But if he had asked me, if he had treated himself like everyone else, he would have to ask me for permission. So then that wouldn't necessarily be a problem. It would depend on the third condition, that once he asks me, so then what is my policy? Do I say yes to everyone? Or I only say yes to him because he lent me money, so then if I treat him differently than I would treat everyone else, that's a problem. So in the Shulchan Aruch, they quote all these three considerations, that if it's very public, or if he's just assuming he can do it without asking me because he feels I must be indebted to him, or if he did ask me but I only allow him because of the loan, I don't allow anyone else, so then that's where you potentially have such an issue.
Right. With regard to the public issue, though, it might be public that he's saying in Aruch, but wouldn't people also make a fair assumption that he's lending it to him and he's paying me for it? Why would anybody ever assume that,
that he's not
that
paying?
He's not paying.
It's a good question.
He's doing it because of this loan.
Yeah, it's a fair question. Maybe that's a reasonable assumption under some circumstances, but the principle that the Tosfos and Shulchan Aruch glean from the example is that it creates, that the example was meant to give a representation of something that's public and visible and creates the appearance of interest. So that's one case where you have such a problem. The Gemara also talks about Ribbis Dvarim, which sounds a little bit like it's a high school kind of thing. Basically means that I lent him money, and in return, he hangs out with me, basically. He's going to talk to me. He's going to say hello to me. So the ribbis that comes through words. That's why it sounds a little bit like a high school kind of thing. You want to be popular, so you lend money to the guy, so he's got to be seen with you and hang out with you and eat with you at the lunch table. What makes it especially high schoolian is that some of the Rishonim feel that's actually potentially Ribbis Daraisa. The Gemara quotes a pasuk. So some Rishonim say it's a pasuk, but it's an asmachta, it's not the real meaning of the pasuk. And other Rishonim understand that it really is a Ribbis Daraisa. But the problem is, for it to be Daraisa, it would have to be part of the original deal. So you can imagine just how high schoolian that is. Okay, I'm contracting that I'm lending you money, and in return you have to pay back the money and you have to hang out with me. It's hard to imagine people doing that. But theoretically, if that was the way you did it, so then some Rishonim would say that's even Ribbis Daraisa. But if you don't contract it, so it can't be Daraisa, but maybe that's a concept of Rabbanan, that if you're going to be especially nice to the person, even just verbally, that's potentially a violation of this Avak Ribbis, Ribbis Dvarim. So I think Zev was up first. Anyone?
Yeah,
unless you want to lend me money, and I'll call on you first. I'm just kidding. Yeah, sorry. That was an example of what I can't do. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the problem. So believe it or not, so Rav Moshe Feinstein was not sure that you could even say thank you.
What was the question?
Is flattery a part of it? So it's a whole discussion. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach assumed that to say thank you is basic decency. That's just basic human reasonableness. So he said it can't possibly be that that's considered to be a violation of this principle. But others weren't so sure. You have to figure out what the best expression is. So then the question is, can you say, all right, tiskel mitzvahs? So then that's a blessing. A blessing maybe is more of a gift. So there's a whole debate what exactly is acceptable. Let me read Shlomo Zalman is probably accepted on this point, that a basic thank you is a normal expectation for somebody who's helping you out. That's not considered to be a gift. But going beyond that gets a little tricky. So there's actually a whole literature that the assumption is it's not just spoken word, but it's presumably also the written word. So here in this building, on the first floor, so you have all the donors whose name is on the wall, and they publish svarim, so you have all the people who contributed to the publishing of the Sefer, their names are in the Sefer. So I don't think anybody would think any of that is a problem, because those people presumably donated the money straight out. But what if they loaned it? If they loaned the money and then it gets returned once the book sells, let's say, so then is it a problem to put their names in the book so the whole, for next 500 years, everyone will look at the Sefer and see that they lent money? So some poskim thought that was a problem. They thought that that was an issue of Ribbis Dvarim, and others thought there were grounds to be lenient, especially because this is not something you just do for them, you do for others also. In general, the halacha says there is a value to publicizing the people who do mitzvahs, the people who support important projects. We want other people to follow their path, and we want people to feel that they're going to be recognized for what they do, so they'll do more of it. So the halacha in general recommends those plaques downstairs and the mentions in the Sfarim in general. So even if it's alone, there are some poskim who say that that itself justifies it. Hi. Yeah, so
it is. The tzedakah is not really there. It's never their mind. The first place, like, why shouldn't one,
right,
the widely universally accepted ideal, at least, that we shouldn't do that?
So I think, yes, I think it's a valid philosophical question. It's not so crucial to understand Ribbis, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but just to quickly address it, so I think there are a couple ways to address it. One is that you don't do it for them, you do it for everyone else, that they should feel motivated to act, so it's nice of them, they want to be modest, but we want to encourage people in general. And I think also it's the recognition of human nature, that while it would be wonderful if everyone would step up to the plate without being recognized, the fact is we're more interested in increasing tzedakah than we are in decreasing the kavod given to the people who give tzedakah. No, it's not an aveira, you know, so it's not really lifnei iver. And we have a higher goal that mitzvahs should be increased rather than not giving anybody recognition for mitzvahs. So the Medrash has a statement, for example, the Torah says that Reuven saved Yosef from the pit by having him sold instead of left in the pit to die. So it's kind of a low-level saving. The Torah says he saved Yosef. You know, he saved him in kind of a low-level way. He was imprisoned all those years. It worked out well in the end, but he, you know, it didn't seem like it was really such a gift. So the Medrash says that if Reuven had known that what he was doing was going to be written down in the Torah, he would have put Yosef on his shoulders and marched him home safely. He would have gone so much further than what he did had he known this would be something that would be recorded for the generations. There's a lot to figure out about what that means. Could also just be a reflection of the significance it has in history, and not just necessarily about COVID. But that's a human nature to a certain extent. So is it great, is it even better if people are able to step up to the plate and not take any recognition? Great, but that's not our problem. Our problem is that we're more interested in encouraging and increasing the amount given to tzedakah than we are in making sure nobody gets credited for it. And there's a value for getting credit for it because of the behalf of the other people. So even if somebody doesn't want it, there's but the question about when that's a good idea and when it's not a good idea. So all of that being the case, so there was a whole discussion about how exactly that should be handled in light of the whole Ribbis Dvarim consideration. Then you have this lower level Ribbis, a Mechzika Ribbis, that, let's say, for example, you have what's known as Ribbis Mucheres and Ribbis Mukdemes, early Ribbis and late Ribbis. So let's say I give a gift to somebody who has not yet lent me money, but I'm hoping that he will. So I give him a gift now in anticipation that he's going to lend me money soon. So that is what we call Ribbis Mukdemes. That's early Ribbis, and that's a low level Drabanan. We don't make you return it after the fact, even morally, but it's something to avoid. Some of the posts can point out it theoretically could be Ribbis Minatora if you make it contingent. If you give a gift to somebody, and then you say he hopes to lend you money next week, and if he doesn't, you're taking the gift back, so then that may actually be actual Ribbis Minatora. But if you don't make it explicitly contingent, so then it's just a kind of low-level Drabbanan. And Ribbis Mucheres means after you paid back the loan already, then you give this gift afterwards, which includes also at the time that you're paying it back. At the time you paid it back and any time after, so then that's this low-level Drabbanan of Ribbis Mucheres. Which means anytime after, it's got to somehow be perceived as connected to the loan. Somebody lent you money 20 years ago, and you give them a gift today, and nobody remembers or ever was a loan, so nobody would call that Ribbis Mucheres. There's got to be some type of reasonable connection in the time period to the gift, to the original loan, And even then, there are circumstances where we allow it. A very small token gift after the time is over is considered to be permitted. It also comes up sometimes, let's say you send somebody on a mission, somebody is in the mall, so you say, okay, could you buy this item for me? And they'll pay you back. So then he lays out the money and buys you something. It's essentially a loan. And then he comes back, and so you want to pay him. So if you overpay him, theoretically, that would be ribis mucheris. However, there are circumstances where that's okay. Let's just see if these are any of your questions. Let's say, for example, if the item costs $99.99, you give him a $100 bill because it's not worth it to either of you to try to find a penny. So then that's not considered to be for ribis purposes. Also, maybe if he doesn't remember exactly how much it costs because it was with all the other stuff, so you want to be safe, so you want to give him the higher number. That's also permitted. And also, I think there is a compelling approach as well, that let's say you do give the person extra, so you should have in mind, why are you doing that? Are you doing it because you're grateful because he laid out the money? Not really. Probably, if you have any motive to give him extra, it's because he did physical labor for you in obtaining it. You're grateful that he carried out the mission. So I think it's reasonable to have that in mind if you give him anything extra and say that this is for the mission, not for the laying out of the money, and that should also help things. Right?
I understand that like you can't make a profit lending money out. Mm-hmm. Like that. If someone lends somebody money for 10 years, then inflation can make a real difference on a large sum of money. So what if someone were to index however much they pay back for inflation? Is that considered ribis, or is that considered just paying back the actual value so they don't take a loss?
Yeah, so that's actually an interesting question. So the short answer is yes, that is a problem, but there are a lot of ways to address some of the issues that come out of that. So just let's look at some of them for a second. So just let's address that for a second. One of the, you have a question about that or
no,
it's a separate question?
Okay.
So let's address that for a second, and then we'll come to Yonatan's question. So one of the other issues, midrabanan. This is a important one, but this also relates to Ilan's question, because this is an area where, on the one hand, there's a rabbinic prohibition, but there's also a pretty easy workaround. So it's an interesting question, why did the rabbis create a prohibition if they also made it so easy to work around? And I think, again, the answer is because it's about, they don't want it to look like ribis, so if you're accounting for it, you're preventing it from looking like ribis. But there's a prohibition called sabisa, which means as follows. So let's say if I have a bag of potatoes, and I say, I'll lend you the bag of potatoes, and you have to pay me back two bags of potatoes. So that's straight out ribis minatoru, because like we said, ribis applies to commodities also. So it's not just cash commodities, that would be straight out ribis minatoru. But let's say I lend you a bag of potatoes, and you have to pay me back a bag of potatoes. So then you should say, okay, that's not ribis, I'm paying you back the same thing that you lent me. The problem is, we're concerned about something. We're concerned that the bag of potatoes may go up in value. The price may fluctuate, and therefore you're going to end up, I lend you a bag of potatoes that costs $10. You paid me back a bag of potatoes, it's worth $12. Essentially, I lent you $10, you paid me back $12. So that is a problem. So therefore, the rabbis made a gezeirah that you shouldn't lend like that. Now, that sounds like a big problem, except there are pretty easy ways to get around it. Discuss a second, Gabriel, a question about that?
Yeah, can you be right about the opposite situation also?
That it goes down.
Is it ribis if you ask for money back just in accordance with inflation?
So that's right. That's Brett's question, basically. So that's okay. So just to address that essentially, that's a problem with commodities, that we're worried the price is going to go up, and then you're going to end up getting more. So the rabbis prohibited that kind of lending. Now, how do you address that practically? We'll come back to that in a second. But in terms of currency, so for the most part, that's less of an issue, because the halacha defines currency, even though this is not the way we perceive it in modern economics. In modern economics, we'll say the dollar goes up and down and it changed value today. Inflation and the like, and deflation in whichever direction we're going. But halacha defines currency as that which does not change. That is the standard by which everything else changes. So a dollar is a dollar. and the value of potatoes changes in comparison to the dollar. And therefore, that's why this prohibition doesn't apply to lending currency. Now, there are some interesting variables. So, for example, some of the poskim assert, that means, assuming that it really doesn't change, but you could also have coins, let's say, for example, that actually do have physical value and actually do change in value despite the fact that they're also a currency. Does that complicate things? Possibly. In our society, it's less of an issue. But the value of a dollar pretty much stays even. So if I'm going to say, I lent you a dollar and you have to pay me back $100 or whatever, $1.50 because of inflation, then that definitionally is a problem of ribis. That's assuming it's the currency in your country. Take a question in a second, but if you're using a foreign currency, so a foreign currency is going to be a commodity compared to the currency. So the pound or the shekel or the yen in America is a commodity, and therefore, if you deal with foreign currency exchange, that's going to be theoretically a problem. Again, there are ways to deal with it, but theoretically, it's a problem in America for me to lend you British pounds because you pay me back in pounds, the pounds changed value in between, so you end up paying me more, perhaps. So the prohibition of sa b'sa, at least theoretically, should apply to foreign currencies, which is something you're going to have to account for. Now, there's also a discussion, could you have more than one currency in a country? Let's say you're in Israel, and shekelim is definitely a currency, but you find that a lot of people are able to do business with dollars, and nobody ever refuses the dollars, and all the businesses take dollars. So is it possible that there are actually two currencies in a country? That was a discussion in Poskim, but that comes up all the time. So you're learning in yeshiva in Israel, and you borrow dollars from somebody. Is that a problem, maybe, of sa b'sa, because the dollar could change value related to the shekel in between, and should it be subject to such a prohibition? So if it is, you have to figure out how do you address this issue. It's relatively easy to address. I'll tell you in a second after we take Avi's question.
Yeah, I just want to be sure. You're saying that a dollar is a dollar and that won't change. But is that only true when the dollar was backed, or dollar backed by gold, or the currency itself was made of gold?
No.
I hear that logic when it was, for sure, when the coin itself was the value. But now with the dollar is clearly just representative of nothing.
But it doesn't necessarily...
The dollar doesn't change value from a logic standpoint unless you're just holding on to the old system.
Well, if it's representative of nothing, all the more so it doesn't change. Right? The point is it's basically a unit of measurement. It's not possible for it to change. That even though in other systems we will talk about the dollar being worth less or worth more, but really what we mean is, so for example, you say the dollar is worth less, it means that I can buy less food for that same dollar, or I can pay less rent, you know, less time in my apartment for that dollar, or the car is going to cost me many more dollars. All of those are ways of saying the dollar is worth less. But in the view of halacha, what we really mean is that the price of cars went up, the price of rentals went up, the price of everything else went up, and the dollar stayed the same. That this is the one constant, and everything else changed in relation to that. And that would probably be true, presumably it's true, regardless of how you came to it. But if the dollar is how we do our business, that becomes the standard, even though it's a question of perspective. But that's essentially how the halacha is going to define it. Gabriel, question about that?
Is there a halachically permissible way to charge interest?
Yes. Well, that sentence, no. Because that's a problem. The sentence is a problematic problem. Is there a way to
get more money back?
Yes, theoretically. So hopefully we'll get to it today. We'll see how many things we can... we have to get to it today, hopefully, because we have to see how much more time we can spend on this. But yes, as we mentioned last week, do not... Whatever we get up to today, don't walk out of here thinking all the businessmen you know are terrible transgressors, because there are ways to deal with it. We just have to put it in the proper context.
Also, do we speak about if you work at a bank or something like that?
Yeah, we spoke about it a little bit before, that there is a big debate about how to explain banks. So we mentioned a few minutes ago that lending money to banks is a debate, but there are many grounds to be lenient based on Moshe Feinstein. Lending money from a bank is a bigger problem, but again, there are many who are lenient for various reasons. if you're not lenient on these issues, so then that gets up to the heteriska that we haven't explained yet, that we have on our agenda, hopefully for today, to explain how a heteriska works. But in general, all the things that we're talking about, if we say it's a problem, what do we mean? So we mean you need a heteriska in most cases. Sometimes the heteriska doesn't work either. Hopefully today we'll explain what a heteriska is. You're on time.
Two questions. So someone lays out the money for you,
mm-hmm.
And he wants to be mochel on some of the money, like he has only paid back 50 instead of 100. That's not gross at all because.
It depends why he's being mochel. That essentially. Okay, just before I forget, remind me, after I answer his question, I may still have to explain how you deal with the sabasa issue. So let's not drop that point. But in terms of your question, so in general, a person can't be mochel to pay rivis. Right, so to say that you lend me $90, I'll pay you back $100. So I can't do that, even though I'm willing to do it. That's the problem. However, some cases it's not necessarily going to be called ribbis. That here it's ribbis after the fact. It's not ribbis minatara for sure, because I never arranged with you that I was going to do this. So it's not ribbis minatara. The question is it some type of rabbinical ribbis? After the fact, I'm paying you back for what you laid out for me, and now here's an extra dollar that comes along with it. Right, you paid less, and now you paid $99, and I'm giving you $100. So theoretically, that could be a rabbinical prohibition of late ribbis mucheres. But there are circumstances where that is permitted. So, for example, if it's a very negligible amount, it's just not worth the effort. I'd give up a dollar rather than spend the time trying to find the change. That's why I'm doing it. Then that's itself permissible. Or if it's just an effort to try to make sure I'm paying you enough because I don't know exactly how much you laid out. Or again, I think it's also very compelling, a person in that position. I don't see this so much in the Svarim, I just think it makes sense, and I think it's true, that if I'm giving you an extra dollar or an extra amount in those circumstances, what's motivating me to do it? Not because you laid out the money, that was nothing to you. You put it on your credit card, you didn't notice. The reason I'm giving you extra is because you went and did something physically for me. You went and purchased it for me. So I'm certainly allowed to pay you for that. I certainly can pay you for doing a job for me. So I think that's the easiest approach to that question. That if you end up overpaying somebody who purchased something on your behalf, you should have in mind that you're paying him for the effort, not for the loan.
What if the person that's laid out the money is nice to you and you just...
He has the right to be mochel. That's fine. You shouldn't do it because you should pay him what he laid out for you. But if he really doesn't care, he doesn't have to care. Another point, just in terms, because you're bringing it up. So in terms of mechila, when it comes to ribbis, I didn't want to get into this so much, but just like it's also important to be aware. Sorry, this is such a massive topic. I'm just trying to just focus on the things that come up in practicalities, but there's just a lot. So there is also a rule. Like I said, I can't willingly pay you ribbis. That is a prohibition. Even though I'm happy to do it, I'm not allowed to pay you. But let's say Yonatan lends me money. I pay him back the money, and I pay him interest. Not allowed to do that, right? So now Yonatan has a Torah obligation, the mitzvah and a Torah, a separate mitzvah, to return the money to me, to return the extra ribbis. So let's say I say to him, you know what, I don't need it back. You don't have to give it back to me. Am I allowed to do that? Am I allowed not to take it back? So this was a machlokas harishonim. The Rambam thought that, yes, you're allowed to do that. That even though I can't voluntarily pay it in the first place, I can voluntarily not take it back and absolve you of your obligation to return it to me. And others disagreed. The Magid Mishnah and the Ravid, they said, the Onim, they said, what do you mean? The whole principle of ribbis is that I can't do it even voluntarily, so what difference does it make before the fact or after the fact? So some explain that maybe what the Rambam believes is that the reason you can't pay it voluntarily is what Yosef was saying before. Why, if I'm a victim, why can't I pay it voluntarily? One view might be that maybe we don't think it's ever really voluntary, that we think I have economic pressure, I need the loan. So really the Torah says you shouldn't be able to charge me for the loan, but I have no choice. I'm not going to get the loan any other way, so I feel compelled to pay for it. You're basically taking it against my will. But if it's after the fact already, I already paid the ribbis. and now you're going to give it back to me. I already got my loan. So why would I feel compelled not to take it back? So maybe that's the whole issue, that maybe the Torah is worried it's not really voluntary. You say it's voluntary, but it's not really. But once you've already paid it, and the guy's giving it back to you, maybe that's why there's a difference. Maybe it really is voluntary in that case. I think there's another way to explain it also, that you could say that, as we said, ribbis is really an offense against God. But where is the offense? Like we explained last week, it's when you make the deal under those circumstances. You say that I will not lend you the money unless you guarantee me that you will pay me interest. So it's a little bit counterintuitive. If I were to ask you, what's the big moment of offense when you collect interest? Is it the charging of interest in the initial deal? Or is it the actual taking the money away from the guy? So you probably would have thought it's the taking money away from him that's the problem. But based on the explanation that we gave last week, you could see why it's not so much that that's the issue. And there may not be any offense to this guy. He's happy to pay it. It's the deal that's the problem. So based on that explanation, you could say that insisting that you agree to a contract to ribbis, that's when I really offended God, so to speak. And the fact that I collected the money in the end, that's not really actually the prohibition. That's just a result of this initial bad deal. So I can't really fix the prohibition by giving it back to you, because that the offensive thing that I did was the arrangement in the first place. So even if I paid you back the money afterwards, I'm not fixing anything. So why am I paying you back the money then? Because the money is not legitimately mine. I don't have a right to keep it, so I have to give it back to you. But if you don't care, you say it's all right, you can keep it, then fine. I have the right to keep it. Because maybe it's two different things. The prohibition to insist on ribbis in the first place is totally distinct from the issue of collecting and keeping the ribbis. So that's how the Rambam understands, maybe. And the Rambam is actually the view that's accepted in Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says that even though ribbis minatoru, you have to pay back, but if the person doesn't want to take it back, you don't have to give it back to them. And the Taz went further. The Taz, this was not really accepted by anyone. The Taz says, if he doesn't ask for it back, it means he's mochel. So the later poskim didn't go that far. They said, you have to offer it back. You have to be ready to pay it back. And then if the guy doesn't want to take it, then you don't have to push it on him. But you do have to offer it. The Taz went further. The Taz said that if the borrower doesn't request it back, you're not obligated to pay it because it's as if he's mochel. That's not the generally accepted view.
Why is that not the same problem as Ribbis
Mukhar? Ribbis Mukhar is in order to let you keep it after the fact?
Yeah.
So, theoretically, the problem with Ribbis Mukhar is that it's an action that looks like Ribbis. So here, you're not doing anything, you're failing to do something. And in the case of Ribbis Mukhar, you're also not required to give it back. So even if we call it Ribbis Mukhar, it's like a passive Ribbis Mukhar, which already is better, and the rule of Ribbis Mukhar is you're not obligated to give it back, so it's going to fall out. Anyway, so to go back to Sal B'Sal for a second, so how do we permit Sal B'Sal? How do we deal with it? First of all, in general, it doesn't apply if you're dealing with very small, like neighborly amounts. So your next-door neighbor needs to borrow a cup of sugar, so we're not necessarily so concerned that later on in the day, after your wife comes back from the supermarket, you give them back a cup of sugar, it's going to change value radically from one point to the other. We're talking about commodities of a little bit more of a substantial quantity. That's A. But B, there's a very easy workaround, so to speak, called Yeshlo, which means, let's say I want to borrow potatoes from you. And I have a potato. I say, I have potatoes, but I can't reach them right now. I have potatoes that are in my attic, and my attic's locked, and my son has the key, so I can't get them right now. So will you lend me potatoes? So then, the way we view it, it's as if I am selling you, I'm makning to you, so to speak, the potatoes that I have that I can't reach right now. So you give me potatoes I can use, and the potatoes that I have elsewhere, they're yours. So then, even if they change value, it doesn't matter because I gave them to you already from the moment you made the loan. So that helps a lot. So you'll say, what do you mean it helps a lot? How often is it the case that when I want to borrow a commodity, I have that commodity somewhere else? That's probably pretty rarely the case. So the truth is, it's often the case, because first of all, you don't have to have the same quantity. If I want to borrow a whole bag of potatoes and I have one potato, that's enough, because the potato I'm giving you right now could be proportionate to any one of the potatoes you're giving me. And even if I don't have that one potato, the lender can give me a potato as a gift. So if he gives me one of the potatoes, so now I have a potato, now I can borrow all the other potatoes in against that one potato I have.
So that
right, so I have one potato, so he gives me one potato, and then he can lend me all the other potatoes.
So you have to give him back one.
Right, one less potato. Right, but it's pretty easy to do, though. Right.
Because it's a loss if you're not dealing with actual potatoes.
Yeah, well, I think you could always have a relatively small quantity of whatever it is, and then that will be that will allow it to work. So, for example, those who deal with the foreign currency market, so theoretically, it's a problem to be dealing in foreign currencies. But if you have one of the currencies, so then it'll be subject to yesh law. So, if I have 1 pound, I can borrow 1 pounds and do business in pounds in America because of this yesh law principle. So again, you could ask the question, so why would the rabbis create a prohibition that's so easy to deal with? So the answer seems to be, again, that it's not because this is actual ribbis. We're not really saying that you will indeed be profiting in interest through lending a commodity. We're saying that we're worried that it looks like a potential ribbis. So if you're addressing it, so then you're forestalling that appearance, and therefore that apparently was enough to address their concerns. Yonatan.
Why, if the borrower is being machnet to the lender at the time that he's borrowing us, then why is the double fee less than the amount?
The lender is being machnet to the borrower. You heard my wish case about the case where the borrower actually has something.
Let's say he really does have.
So basically, let's pretend for a second that I wanted to borrow a bag of potatoes from you right now, and I told you that in my home in New Jersey I have a bag of potatoes, but it's over the bridge. So I need you to give me your bag of potatoes so I can use them right now. So if that's really the case, so then it's not as if I'm borrowing potatoes today at $10, and next week I'm going to return potatoes when they might be worth $12, and potentially giving you back $12 for 10. What's happening is, the bag of potatoes that's in my home in New Jersey right now, they're yours. Right now, from today, they're yours. So I took potatoes from you, and I'm trading them for the bag of potatoes that's in my house. So even if they would change value between now and then, it doesn't matter. They change value in your possession. So it's not like I'm giving you $12 for your $10. I'm giving you $10 for your $10. And it happens to be when it was in your possession, it went up in value.
What if you only have one potato at home?
Potato could represent any of the potatoes. So that's...
What about the other potato?
Right, so theoretically, it could be machnet to you on behalf of each one. Yeah. Hi.
Would you actually machnet? I mean, like, let's say that we would burn, right? And now you don't have any potatoes after we had done this digital transaction.
Right, so then you can get into some complexities. You have to then figure out whether it's more of a symbolic... See, it's not going to necessarily matter, because theoretically then you're already justified the loan based on that, so that's a question of what happens after the fact. But in terms of Hilchos Kinyanim, you have to figure out exactly what the consequences are. Okay, so... See if we can get Hatariska. Gabriel?
Didn't you say before that the part of Ribbis that makes it not okay is the deal that you make?
Right.
So no one's going to do the deal unless you decide beforehand and you say, I have a bag of 12 potatoes at home. I'm going to tell you that I cannot get them right now. Will you give me these 10 potatoes then? So isn't that part of that conversation, isn't that what you said was...
No, the conversation, what bothers us is when you insist on more. The fact that I'm going to pay you back the potatoes you lent me, the principal, that's what a loan is. What we're worried about is that you're insisting on getting back more than what I gave you. So the way we explained last week the concern about ribbis in general is, I say I want to lend you $100 because you need $100, but I'm only willing to do it if you pay me back $105 because I'm only willing to help you out if you guarantee me a return the same as I was getting in the bank. Nothing exorbitant, very minimal, just the same as I would get in the bank. So we suggested last week that that's an offense against God, because you're basically saying, God, you want me to engage in chesed to help people out? I'll only do it if you guarantee me from the beginning that this helping out people, this chesed, is worth as much to me as investing in the bank. So God doesn't want to hear that. He wants you to say, you're going to engage in chesed, and things will work out. You don't need him to contractually tell you that he'll pay you as much as the bank will pay you. So that's not an offense against the borrower, because the borrower, it's worth it to him. But against God, that's a problem. So that type of deal, ribbis ketsutza, to say, I'm only going to lend you money, I'm only going to help you out, if you guarantee me a return, not a return of the object itself, but a profit, even a very minimal profit that's parallel to anything reasonable, still, that's not the terms under which God said you should be engaging in chesed. Hi.
Does that have to be in your original? Let's say you lend this potato to someone else. So you have potato, but you lend it to someone else, and then you want to borrow it.
Right. If you still have control over it, that you can be marking it to somebody else.
Right now.
Yeah. So that's basically the Gemara explains it, that it's locked up right now. I can't access it, but it's mine. So I give it to you. So I want to hopefully get to Iska, if not today, then next time. But just to mention that in a business context, so you have a lot of potential ribbis as well. When you're dealing with a business context, things get knocked down already. It's already a drabbanon. It's already not considered to be a straight-out loan. It's already a different level. I should also mention, somebody brought this up, maybe it's related a little bit to Brett's question about, let's say you keep the money for 10 years. So there is a complex halachic question which actually impacts on a lot of areas of business law. But let's say I lend somebody money and he's supposed to pay it back February 1st. And he doesn't. He keeps it longer. And now it's almost March 1st. And in the month while I was waiting for him to pay me back the money, so I couldn't pay my rent and I got kicked out of my apartment, and I had to go into a more expensive place, or I had to close down my business because I couldn't pay my creditors, whatever it is, I suffered financial loss because of this guy failing to pay me back the loan on time. So now I want to charge him for the loss. Am I allowed to do that? So that's a complex question. It comes up all the time. Some of the Israeli posts can discuss. Joseph Lieberman has a truth about this. Now that he's retired from the Senate, he has more time. There's a Israeli postdoc by the name of Rabbi Yosef Lieberman, who was not the senator. So he has a truth about this. This happens all the time. Let's say you have a contractor who took too long to build your new place, and now you have to pay more rent than your old place. So theoretically, you're charging for time. Hi.
So how does the Israeli government get around that one?
Get around which one?
The contractor taking a lot
of money. Well, the Israeli government's not involved with the contractors, but the question between the two parties themselves. So if somebody causes you a loss because they took too long to do the job or to pay you back a loan, so then there is a discussion whether or not that would be considered ribbis. And a lot of poskim believe that that's something else. That's probably not ribbis. That's a payment. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Arbach even has a tshuva, for example. Let's say, there's a couple aspects to the question. Before we get to Shlomo Zalman's point, first of all, one question is it ribbis to charge for the loss that was created? This is not a loss of profit from the bank. This is not the interest that you would have gotten in the bank you want to make him pay. That, for sure, you're not allowed to do. But if I say, I'll lend you $100 for a month, but you should pay me for the lost interest in the bank, that's straight out charging interest. That's the whole thing you're not allowed to do. But let's say I had to pay some fee because you kept the money too long and you caused me a loss. So then the question has a couple of parts to it. One is it considered to be ribbis to collect that money? Very possibly not. That's something different than ribbis. That's a compensation for the loss that was caused. And the other half of the question is separate. This is a big business law issue. Separate from the ribbis question, is the other party liable? If I caused you to lose money, or lose business, because I held back your assets, you needed your assets to do business, and you didn't have them because I held on to them, and now you lost business, Am I liable for that? If I prevent you from profiting? So that's a complex question. It's very possible that's not an actual liability. But there's a lot of literature about that. It's a two-part question. Is there a genuine liability there? And would paying for that liability run afoul of ribbis? So the second part of the question is a little easier. Many postmen feel that's probably not ribbis. And the question is, when are you liable under those circumstances? So it's going to depend on a lot of factors that are a little bit outside the scope of a ribbis discussion. Maybe we'll find space within the context of this course to talk about it. But let's say it's not a question of liability, but you feel like you should, on your own, pay it. That you recognize you caused somebody problems, the money was due a month ago, and you never got around to paying it on time. So you feel bad. So can you volunteer to say, listen, I feel bad, I caused you problems, I'll throw in a few extra bucks to make you feel better. So that very possibly you can. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach thought that was legitimate to try to appease the person who you have wronged by holding on to his money too long. It wasn't the original deal, you kept it beyond the date. So to appease him with money is probably not considered to be a violation of ribbis. You have another question about that?
Do you specifically, you have to have damaged in order for this to happen? Or if he holds on to the money past the date where it was due, can you just charge him for like regular opportunity costs? Just like,
yeah, so it depends again. Are you talking about liability in the enforceable sense? Or are you talking about if the borrower decides he wants to... He wants to contribute because he feels bad.
No, I just mean in the beginning examples you're talking about, like losing business because he didn't pay it back on time or anything like that.
To charge him is difficult to do. To say that I want you to pay, you caused me opportunity costs. So this is a whole separate halachic discussion. But that's generally called grumma. That grumma means if it's causational, that you didn't come and break my property with a hammer. You didn't smash my windshield and damage my property that way. I have less money because you did something that resulted in me not profiting the way I normally would have. So in general, that's causational, and you're usually not able to collect that. Now, there are exceptions, and there are all kinds of in-between situations. Sometimes the connection between my loss and your actions is more direct, and sometimes there is some ability to enforce that. But under a normal circumstance, I can't force somebody to pay me for a lost opportunity. So that's in terms of what I can compel. Now, maybe the borrower himself feels bad. He says, I recognize that you would have done better had you not lent me money. So I feel bad. I want to throw in some bucks because I kept it past the date. That's a different story. So that's interesting. It may be that holding on to the money is stealing. And therefore... Right, so, sorry?
Don't you have to pay kefil?
So no. So that's, it gets into other complexities. The Torah says that if you steal somebody's property and you get caught with it, then you have to pay double, give back the item and pay the value again, pay double. But we don't impose that nowadays because that's called a knas, that's a penalty, and you need to have a fully ordained Sanhedrin in order to impose that. So nowadays we don't do that, we only pay the actual value. So, strictly speaking, now your question is another, it's a good one for another reason, that that's something that some of the poskim consider, that if I fail to pay back a debt on time, is that called stealing? If I'm holding on to somebody's money beyond the time he let me do it, right? He said, here's $100, you can keep it till February 1st, and instead, and that was our agreement, and now I held on to it from February 1st to February 27th, is that considered to be stealing? Without any act of theft, I didn't reach into his pocket, but I held on to his money beyond the time I was allowed to, that might be considered stealing, and that's part of the question, because if it is, then maybe is it justified to say, okay, I have to do tshuva, I have to appease him somehow. The Bezdin's not going to force me to pay more because we don't impose those type of penalties in a contemporary... Bezdin can force you to pay back the amount itself, but not beyond... But I might decide that it's appropriate and morally correct to try to appease this person by throwing in something extra. And that is probably legitimate. But it's less likely that he can compel me to. You'd have to have a pretty extreme case, because normally it's considered to be causational, and I'm generally not liable for that in a formal sense. But sometimes yes, depends on the circumstances. So that's a good question also. Is that considered to be a apostolate? It's probably not, because not every not everything that's called gezel automatically disqualifies you for aides. It has to be a little bit more more overt and a little bit less rationalizable. That it's the kind of things that people believe is not really theft, even if halachically it is. We often find that doesn't necessarily provoke a psul eides. Hi.
Going back a little bit and speaking more about Torah Mitzvahs, like what the difference would be between
So the Torah Mitzvahs actually connects to this point that if I want to use the late fees as a way to kind of get around Ribbis, that was something that Rashba introduced into the conversation. Maybe that's another form of Ribbis Drabanan. But it also gets to this point that if you have late fees theoretically are justifiable. It depends on a little bit of the machlokas aposkim, when and how. It's easier in the context of a business because already everything is on a lower level to begin with. So if a business wants to say that if you don't come through at a certain point, we're going to charge you a late fee, so then that might be justifiable with a combination of a couple factors. First of all, it's a genuine late fee rather than interest, meaning that it's not triggered all the time. It's only triggered after a certain point of excess, whatever that is. And YU has this problem because, you know, YU rents apartments, for example, to the students. And part of the contract is that if the rent is not paid by a certain time, so there is a late fee. So is that ribbis? They're waiting for their money, and they're going to charge more if they have to wait more for their money. So there's a lot of different considerations. Is YU called it stucker? That's also part of the conversation. Is YU a corporation? Can't pay ribbis d'oraisa. The question is this considered to be ribbis to begin with? So if it's phrased as a late fee, so that might make a difference. It has to legitimately be a late fee, which means that it's not automatic. It only comes in after a certain point. Also, one of the considerations post can invoke in that context is it should be a one-time late fee. It's not that, okay, after a week it's going to go up this much, and after 2 weeks it's going to go up that much, and after 3 weeks it'll be that much. And then it really begins to look like interest. If it's a one-time late fee, that, okay, you missed this deadline, it goes up to this, then that's a little bit more justifiable. So we have to have a couple of considerations. So if you were to do that in the context of a loan, in a way that's really essentially just a roundabout way of getting interest, but calling it a late fee, that's what the terminus rivis consideration is about.
Hi. Let's say you were to, like, why use situation with the department, like, 2 weeks after the fact that they didn't pay, they say if you don't pay within 2 weeks, you're going to get a fine.
Right.
Right? What happens if, like, 2 months later, they still don't pay?
I don't know what they do in policy. I don't know what they're actually...
Logically, my grandfather's a landlord. My grandfather kicked him out. But,
right.
Like, after a certain amount of time,
right, so
kicking
him out shouldn't it increase?
Shouldn't it increase?
Yeah, theoretically, yes, but in one of the barometers that's used to figure out whether it's interest or whether it's a late fee is, does it keep on accruing per time, right? Or is it a one-time punishment in order to encourage you not to get to that point? So the premise of a late fee initially should be, if it's a justified late fee, right, the premise should be that I don't want you to pay a late fee. I want you to pay on time. So the basic premise should be that you will pay on time and there won't be any increase, and it's only if we get to a certain point. So that's one of the questions. Are we doing it as a way to discourage lateness rather than to collect more money? And part of the barometer is it going to keep going up, or is it a way to really get everything in by a certain date? And one of the ways to look at that is, does it happen once, or does it happen beyond that? And your point is well taken, that what's your grandfather going to do if he doesn't pay? Eventually he's going to evict him. He's not going to keep raising the rent and say, okay, you didn't pay me the first time, it keeps going up and up. He'll eventually take other kind of actions.
Are you able to, let's say, the person doesn't pay the rent, say, 2 or 3 months in a row, right? And they incur, but they don't pay 2 or 3 months in a row on time. They pay late, and they have to incur the late fee. Could you theoretically increase their rent because
you don't, you're not getting paid?
Because you can't trust them?
Except that increasing the rent is not a way of ensuring trust, it's a way of getting more money. Like, if you say that normally I collect the rent later, but now I insist on it being earlier because I don't trust you to pay on time, that would be a way of dealing with their trust, you know. But if you say I'm not going to turn on your electricity until you pay the rent or something like that, you know, that's a way of imposing trust upon them. I don't know if making it more is going to do that. Okay, again, it's not absolute that their late fees can't ever be more than once, but it's a way of, if you want to ask the question, is this a late fee or is it interest? So if it's a one-time charge, it looks more like a late fee. If it's progressive, then it looks more like interest. Hi.
Also, in terms of specific property, would one of you suggest that there's differences just because, like what we were talking about in your other class with ownership rights? So because if this person really owns the place where you're living, so he can impose really whatever he wants on you, tell you to get out, or maybe it's not so simple if you're renting it, but now that you've violated already the contract, you're not paying up the money, so we can say, okay, so I demand now that you also give me this extra fee.
Yes and no. I mean, it all depends on a couple of different factors that you just alluded to in this sense. You know, one is that, yes, the owner theoretically has the right to set things wherever he wants, but theoretically, on the other hand, a renter may have some kind of rights once he rents, and an ongoing relationship between two parties usually involves certain guarantees that they can't just impose.
By violating it now, by not paying up.
So then it provokes a fourth question, that if I break an agreement between the two parties, at what point does that vitiate our entire agreement and all bets are off, or are there other lower key remedies that, okay, I didn't do this, you get to do that, but it doesn't necessarily mean everything's out the window. So it's a little bit of a complex kind of question. So at this rate, we'll probably get up to Heteriscan next week. Again, don't think badly of any of the businessmen until next week. Then hopefully not either, but you should recognize there is a way to deal with these questions. But one of the other issues that comes up in business, this is kind of a complicated scenario, but there are ways to address this also, is that when businesses, this is kind of the other side of the late fee question, what about if businesses charge different rates depending on when you pay? So if they give you a lower rate for paying earlier, that theoretically is a problem, because theoretically what it means is that you're lending them the money, and in return for the money, they are giving you more service than they would have otherwise, or more product than they would have otherwise. So let's say, for example, you go to a gas station, and the gas station has two prices, one for credit cards and one for cash. So let's assume it's not a tax evasion plan. But the other reason why they might do it, the legal reasons, but the... Sorry?
The Cedar Lane gas station.
A what gas station?
The Cedar Lane gas
station. Oh, I don't know. I'm not coming to any specific... But let's assume that it's not about not paying sales tax, but it's about a legal thing, but it's a halachic problem. That they say, if you use a credit card, we're going to have to wait longer to get our money. So we don't want to wait for the credit card to come to pay us cash. We'll have the money right now, so we'd rather charge you less for the cash and make you pay cash than have you pay with a credit card. So theoretically, that could be as if you are lending them money for more service. And that's theoretically a problem. However, there are some ways to address that problem also. First of all, the question is, what's the real rate, the lower rate or the higher rate? If they're giving you a lower rate so that they get the money earlier, then they're giving you a gift for the loan. If they give you a higher rate if you pay later, then they're just penalizing later payment. That's not the same thing as interest. So one question is, what's the real rate? Is the real rate the lower price or the higher price? The other question to consider, which I think is also a valid consideration, so why is the gas station charging you more for the credit card? Is it because they have to wait longer for their money? Or maybe it's because the credit card company charges them a processing fee, or maybe because it's labor. They have to have more work done in order to process all these fees, so they don't want to deal with that, so they charge a little bit more to compensate for that. So then that's legitimate if they are doing it because they want to address their higher costs in processing the credit payment. So that's legitimate also. So these are some considerations that you have. But in general, so if you buy something, let's say sometimes you'll buy a product and they're going to deliver it later. But if you buy it now, so buy it a month in advance, pay for it a month in advance, we'll give you a lower rate. So sometimes that really is kind of a loan. That's actually literally what it is. Why are they doing it this way? Because they haven't made the product yet. They need the capital in order to do it. So because you are advancing them the money, so they're going to give you more product. That really is a literal loan, even though it's done in the business setting. And they're basically paying you interest by giving you more product later. So that's a problem, theoretically. There are ways to deal with it. First of all, again, if you're dealing with companies already, that kind of shifts the whole equation. They already knock things down a little bit. But also, the question is, so what is the story? Is the item manufactured yet? And you're buying it now, they're just delivering it later for some reason? Or does it not exist yet? If it doesn't exist, they have to buy it, they have to make it, and they need your money to do it, then it's more like a loan. If they have this item in the store, and for whatever reason they're not going to give it to you for another month, so then that's legitimate, because that's the same principle, Yeshlo, that we mentioned before, that essentially they machne it to you right away. They'll actually physically give it to you later, but the bicycle that you're paying for now is in their storeroom, and they're going to consider it yours right away, so then that's not considered to be an advance payment. But in this case, it's different than the Yeshlo by the Sal Basal. They have to have as many items as they're actually selling. They can't just have one to sell to everybody. They have to actually have the item per person. So that theoretically makes a difference. So this comes up a lot in a couple of contexts. You know, first of all, like early bird payments for schools and camps comes up all the time. So there, again, corporations is a big help, the fact that you're dealing with corporations. But also there, it's a service rather than a product. So how do you define whether they have it or not? So there, many poskim have argued, well, Yashiv and others have maintained, that so let's say I pay an early bird payment for my kid's going to go to the school next year, going to go to ninth grade in September, and I'm paying now, and he's getting a better deal because I'm paying now. So even though he's not actually in school till next September, but the school exists and is working on behalf of all the future students right now, so it could be understood as I'm paying right now for the services starting immediately, and therefore that's legitimate because, again, the rate essentially could change at any moment. It's basically just a question, am I going to get the service right now? Hi.
I mean, I know the way a lot of places do it is that they register you as if you paid the higher amount, mm-hmm. and then they credit whatever it is, $200 off the total. So isn't that not really like charging you a higher amount for paying later? It's really just they view you signing up now as an advance payment.
That's what makes it good. We're not worried about them charging us more for later. We're worried about them giving us more service for paying earlier. That if I pay less because I paid earlier, so then I'm getting more back for that money. So is it basically like I'm lending them money? That's what we're concerned about.
What I'm saying is that the time that you pay earlier,
mm-hmm.
that's considered like a doing them a favor.
Right, that's all a loan to them.
So doesn't that get around the problem?
Well, that's what we're worried about. If I'm lending them money by giving them money earlier, and in return, they're giving me more product than they normally would give.
I'm saying you don't necessarily need to pay. I think you just need to sign up a lot of these places.
You mean sign up and don't pay?
Yeah.
Right. If that's the case, so then it's not a loan at all, for sure, because then that actually is relevant to another point I'll just make right now, that there is a... We'll see how this comes back to your point. There's also a lot of discussion, what about magazine subscriptions? Newspaper subscriptions. As you subscribe to a newspaper in advance, they give you a much lower rate. So hopefully that's not a case of Yeshlo. Hopefully they haven't prepared the news in advance. They're going to wait till it actually happens to decide what they're going to say about it. So how do you address that? So there are some who think that's a problem, and it gets back to heteriska. So next week we'll have to discuss what heteriska is, a mysterious term. But I think there's a very compelling logic to say that it's not a problem. Because why is the magazine or the newspaper give you a lower rate for early subscription? Because they need your money in advance? Maybe, but probably not. There are two other very compelling reasons why they do it. A newspaper that's really starting up out of nowhere, maybe that's the case. You know, but an existing publication that gives you a lower rate for subscription, so there's two compelling reasons. One is because they sold a whole year's worth of newspapers then, so it's worth it. Not because they get the money in advance, but because they know that they sell a year's worth instead of having to worry each month if they're going to sell the magazine or not. But secondly, as Yonatan was saying, and this is very compelling, is because they make their real money from advertisers. So the way they get money from advertisers is because the more subscribers they have, the higher rates they can charge. So it's worth it to them to basically give it to you for close to nothing to get your name on the list so that they can then bring that to the advertisers. And the proof to that is there are publications that actually do give themselves out for free. So how do they survive? Because they're able to tell the advertisers that everyone in town has this because we give it out for free. Now, of course, the advertisers realize that the papers that everyone gets for free are also less likely to be read in the first place, so they don't pay that much for the ads. But somehow it balances out that these publications that give themselves out for free are able to claim a very wide circulation, and then that's how they get their advertising rates up. So that's probably the real reason why Time Magazine is going to charge you a fraction of the cover price for a subscription, not because they need to borrow your money in advance and it's worth it to pay such a high rate that they'll charge you a quarter of the cover price, but because having you listed as a subscriber is worth much more than the few dollars that you pay for the issue that is not going to make much of a difference.
Just because you mentioned Time Magazine, did you read their latest special report on, it's called Bitter Pill by Medical Builder Companies?
No, but it sounds it's interesting, but we have about a minute left, so just to, I'll ask you about that afterwards. But so basically, does advanced payments are theoretically an issue? So that's but there are ways to address it, and these are some of the ways. And again, since you're mostly dealing with corporations, that also helps. It also comes up, just to quickly mention, so for example, you buy a Kartisia in Israel on the bus, so they give you 11 rides for the price of 10. Theoretically, it's a problem also, but again, some of these same stores apply. They're happy to sell 10 rides, and even if it means they have to throw in an extra one to do it, and it's less time for the driver to process the payments and everything else, it makes sense for them for other reasons, and it's a corporation, so no one thinks this is really a problem. But this does leave us with the all-important topic of heterisco. What in the world is that mysterious term? How in the world does that help anything? So, God willing, next week we will discuss that. Everyone should have a wonderful day. Everyone should reconsider their Meyer plans before the clock makes it impossible. And I will see you next week.
Why are you Shabbos tickets? Why are you Shabbos tickets before Wednesday?
Yeah, it's also a similar issue. It's the same logic kind of applies. Well, you could address it the same kind of way. It's the same question. Hi.